Hello and welcome to the China Business Brief, a podcast by the China Britain Business Council, where we explain the latest news relevant to anyone working in or with the world's second largest economy. I'm Joe Cash, and in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Alicia Garcia Herrera, Chief Economist for the Asia Pacific within Natixis, who's going to take us through the story dominating the China-focused headlines of late, Evergrande Group. Alicia, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So time for a quick précis before we get started. Evergrande is one of China's largest property developers, but over the last year, it has struggled as the government has tightened restrictions around the industry's financing practices. Now Evergrande faces liabilities of over £200 billion, and it was supposed to pay its creditors £61 million in bond interest last Friday. It failed to do so. So now the question is, what happens next? Alicia, once again, welcome to the show. I suppose that's the place to start. What happens next? Do you expect Evergrande's woes to spill over and affect other parts of the market? Are we looking at a controlled demolition of the firm? Or do neither of those examples really fit?
Well, thanks very much for that. Certainly very timely question. Lots of investors across the world are asking themselves what's going to happen next. And I think a couple of things come to mind. First, the usual comparisons you've mentioned, a few of them, such as demolition or the Lima moment for China, or even Enron, which I think is probably more accurate, because what we have in front of us is a humongous company. So there's a lot of inventory, a lot of assets that can be disposed of. It's a company that is also very much exposed to the rest of the world, whether through dollar debt in the Hong Kong offshore market, equity market in Hong Kong, the Hang Seng, but also through projects elsewhere. So basically, it's an Enron, which perhaps has more financial and perhaps overseas implications that Enron did have at the time, but still an Enron, not a Lehman. Why not Lehman? Because this is not a financial institution. And this is very important. Although part of the issuance of onshore bonds by Evergrande are used as collateral for the repo market in China, this is really very minor compared to the bulk of the debt. So just to give a few numbers, so about 60% of that debt is pre-sales. And of course, account receivables. So to put this in context, this means that from 1.2 to 1.5 million Chinese households are waiting for their property to be delivered. And that's the bulk of it. So they've used the money and we can't find the money, nor can we find the properties, at least not yet. And then the account receivables are about 6,000 providers of goods and services in China to Evergrande that have a short-term debt, basically generally 180 days or, you know, and they're waiting to be paid. It is very obvious to me that the Chinese government is ready to do its utmost to avoid any lack of delivery of those units or lack of payment of those providers of services, the account payables, as I mentioned. Because that contagion channel, although it is not the Lehman contagion channel, i.e. not so immediate, it's still very damaging for China because other real estate developers use pre-sales nearly as much as Evergrande does. So it's about 54% of their funding. So they need to cut that contagion link, which basically means that people would stop going to the auctions, buying first-hand property units because of the fear of not being delivered. That's going to happen. And I think the deal is that local governments are going to help. Not that they're in great shape. Evergrande is now selling off its assets as we speak to contribute to the finalization of those housing units. And therefore, the question really is, what comes next to the $20 billion, mainly dollar, a little bit of CNH, offshore renminbi, but mainly dollar bonds that are sitting in Hong Kong, many of which are actually with net worth, high net worth individuals who bought these bonds through private banking in Hong Kong. I think those are going to feel the pinch more than anybody else.
I mean, I agree with you. And last week, there were so many analyses coming out comparing Evergrande with Lehman Brothers. I perhaps unhelpfully decided to add to the mix by writing one for CBBC's Focus magazine. So do check that out if you're listening and want to find out more about the background of what we're talking about today. And my conclusion was that with Lehman Brothers, you had a company that, in a similar way to Evergrande, it had debt spread far across the economy and it had perhaps adopted unsavory operating practices to kind of hide its mismanagement. But ultimately, that was a company that was pulled apart by market forces, whereas Evergrande was a company that perhaps became too complacent in its dealings with the party. And I suppose that joins up with other things that commentators have said, that Evergrande is perhaps one of the first victims of common prosperity, with the focus on trying to make housing more affordable. And of course, that is one of the key drivers in the government's desire to be able to ensure that the people who have invested in Evergrande properties do ultimately receive those properties. What's your take on that? Is this the first sign of common prosperity manifesting itself?
Absolutely. It's a very good question. I think common prosperity is at the core of many things we're seeing lately. Just to give a sense of a timeline to the concept of common prosperity, the first time I think it was mentioned by President Xi was really right before the Ant Financial event, the forced lack of listing of Ant Financial. And I think it does show that somehow the idea of excessive, or maybe we should use this Western term, irrational exuberance, you know, in China, clearly become a key topic in this new China. And why? I guess because common prosperity is hitting the nerve of Chinese, if you see what I mean. If you've been a successful entrepreneur, you suddenly realize that the party doesn't want you to be what actually used to be a good thing to be. It's taken time for the leadership to kind of come to terms with the need to push for this, although I think it was ideologically there. So and now, how to execute it? You know, you could take the Western view of the world, but perhaps the European view of the world. Yeah, you have a welfare state, you increase taxes, which, by the way, this leadership pushed in terms of lowering taxes. China's corporate effective tax is very low, lower than the US, even after the Trump tax reform. It's about 18%, is extremely low because they've been trying to pump up the economy for so long. Yeah, especially during the trade war and so on. So they could have actually said, you know what, we need more taxes and to finance a welfare state, you know, a better distribution of resources. So I think that's not the model. Ours, meaning the West, or at least the European type welfare state, by which you redistribute income through the tax system and government expenditure, is not what China is doing. They have a different thing in mind that to me comes through the centralization of sources of wealth and sources of income. And that goes beyond a tax system because, you know, tax system can kind of control the flow, but at the end of the day, the private sector can, you know, decide to invest or not and therefore pay or not. I'm controlling at the source. Thus, I can basically use up all of that control much more for the purpose that I may have in mind, which probably are income distribution. I'm not saying that that's not important, but it is a very different way to get into that, which of course gives the party and the leadership much more leeway, because this is really basically about their decisions as to how to use those new resources. And by new, of course, it's the private sector. The leeway needs to be taken back. And I think that explains indeed not so much the gloom and doom of Evergrande that was bound to happen, because the real estate market is in decline. So at some point it was going to happen, but more like the actual timing, why it happened, when it happened. How we got there, I think, was very much pushed. I think there was this timing that was indeed a decision which aimed at first controlling housing prices in a way, in a very interesting way, because there's other ways to do it. But, and secondly, to warn developers that this is a business that is in decline. And I think the signal perhaps was a slightly too big. At some point, it went beyond what they thought they could control, and now they're kind of reverting. Evergrande, you're not listing on the EV vehicles. Evergrande, you're selling your assets. Evergrande, you talk to this local government. You know, like basically summoning this company to do what the government wants the company to do before it actually gets intervened.
Yeah, I think this idea that the government's gone too big on the signal it wants to kind of put out is one that we've seen time and again this year. And I think that's behind some of the analysis about, is China uninvestable now? Of course, there was the signal put out at the 100th anniversary of the party, which isn't worth talking about now, which spooked foreign investors. Then it was followed up with dual circulation strategy. is having a large Chinese economy and a smaller foreign economy a sign that China is not welcoming to foreign investment? And now we have the Evergrande situation. What's your take on this idea that China has become uninvestable, looking at the question both from the perspective of the recent crackdowns, but also the underlying general health of China's economy?
Well, I'm going to be slightly blunt and, of course, hopefully constructively so. But to me, it's kind of, I mean, if I were an investor and having gone into China through the reports published by Goldman, it's yes, by all means and purposes. But the point is, they had already said that this was the case and supported China's entry into the MSCI and you name it. So the question really is why you ask the question now and not before. And I think the second part of that report is the best because it kind of highlights the doubt. I mean, why that question is posed now and maybe not before. But it does show that sometimes investors do rush or in a way are induced to rush into a market because of the opportunities and the lack of information on how to measure the risk. Point is, sometimes by rushing, you may actually, ironically, getting into a title like Is China Investable after you've spent 3 years saying that it's not only investable, but it's the best market in the world. So it's like many investors will say, why didn't you bring George Magnus before, my dear? You know, like, to be very frank. So, and this puts all of these international financial institutions that have certainly rushed into China in a very weird situation now. They will need to explain their clients and they will need to bring somebody from far away, i.e. the George Magnus of the world, to explain something that they themselves can't say. Frankly speaking, investors are pretty savvy. And what they're going to see is whether that bond is going to be serviced or not. The answer to that question, whether China is investable or not, in a way has gone past because you already put it in the index, i.e. it is investable. And that's not the question. The question is, are we measuring the risk properly? That's what I think, you know, that piece of research should have answered.
I normally like to end the podcast on an upbeat note, but I don't think we're going to achieve that today. But we have our next research question. I think the point you raised that is this level of risk investable and manageable well worth taking further? Alicia, thanks for coming on the podcast. I hope that we've managed to shed some light on this remarkably complicated situation. I'm not an economist by training, so approaching it over the last week has been eye-opening and challenging. But thank you for providing such great answers.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
And thank you for listening. And we'll see you in 2 weeks' time for another episode of China Business Week. Goodbye. China Business Brief is a podcast brought to you by the China Britain Business Council. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you're subscribed. To find out more about our other events and activities, do check out our website at www.cbbc.org.